Asar B'Teves, Sunday the 23rd of December, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, Recent Advances in Medical Halacha.
First of all, thanks for this opportunity to think together about some of these issues. Asar B'Teves, I suppose the connection would be that the theme of Asar B'Teves is really our conflict with the culture around us that began with Hanukkah and continues now. And you find this conflict very strongly in medical halachic areas where the non-Jewish world has certain principles and we have very different principles. As it happens in Israel, over the last few years, maybe 15 to 20 years, a number of laws have been made that do accord with halacha. I'll try to just point out one or two of those, and maybe that'll be our Asar B'Teves element, is that this is be part of our battle, I guess, against that world where at least in this area of Israeli law, there are points of halacha that do accord with the law. I'll try to explain what I mean, not sure how much time we'll have to, how many of them we're able to discuss, but at least take a couple of them and try to show that. The first one I can think of is that in 1996, there was a law made in Israel that is called, known as the Patients' Rights Act. And what this does is it makes a provision that's probably unique in the whole Western world. And that is you can actually coerce a patient into therapy against their will. Let me try to give a little bit of background to that. You know that in the non-Jewish world today, the medical ethical principles that they use are basically four major principles that are very widely agreed. The first of them is autonomy. That means it's the patient's right to do whatever he wants to himself. That means he can refuse therapy if he wants to. Some cynics have pointed out that although the highest principle is autonomy, usually they give the patient more autonomy to choose not to be treated and die when he wants to, but they don't give him the same autonomy to insist on treatment when their system feels that perhaps he shouldn't. That's an expression of some of the values of in this area today. But there's no question that the top of the list is autonomy. That means the patient is autonomously able to decide what he wants. The second is known as justice. That means what he wants has to be fair. You have to distributive justice. You have to be sure that the limited resources you have are fairly distributed in society. The third is called beneficence, which means whatever you do has to be for the good of the patient. And the fourth is non-maleficence. You may not do something that harms the patient. But there's no question that the sort of preeminent value is autonomy, and that means what the patient wants is what they get, because it is their life, and I'll do what I want with my own life. Halacha does not accord with this. That means there are many cases in halacha where you can override a person's wishes. For example, if a person says, I don't want to be treated, and we have a simple treatment that's painless and risk-free, that means it doesn't risk shortening the dangerously shortened life that they have, then we would be allowed to do that. There's no jurisdiction that I know of today in the West that agrees with that. In other words, in all Western jurisdictions, if a patient says, don't touch me, and we say, look, you're going to die if we don't give you this treatment, you are not allowed to treat. I mean, a classic example would be that in England today, and certainly United States and other Western countries, if a person has, for example, let's say they need a blood transfusion or they'll die, and they refuse the blood transfusion, right? There are certain Christian sects that do not believe in getting blood transfusions. If a person needs a blood transfusion and you say you're going to die if we don't give it to you, it's very, very risk, low risk, and we can save your life. If they say, I don't want it, you are not allowed to touch them. If you do, you're sued for assault. I was in California some time ago where a terminally ill AIDS patient, was brought into the hospital at 2 o'clock in the morning. He had clearly said before that if he was ever in respiratory failure, he didn't want to be ventilated. But it was 2 in the morning, there was nothing in writing. I heard this from one of the doctors whose friend actually this was. There was nothing in writing, the doctor was very hesitant, so to err on the side of caution, he intubated and ventilated the patient. He's now being sued for wrongful life and assault. Okay? If he loses the case, he'll lose his license to practice medicine in California, and that is because he saved the life of a patient. Of course, in Jewish law, we take completely opposite view of this. The only place where Western law, British and American law, has agreed with our attitude here is when it comes to a child. In other words, if a parent says, I don't want a blood transfusion for my child, right, because of my religious beliefs. So here the courts have consistently overruled the parent's wishes. In other words, the legal language is the state has an interest in the survival of the child, That's the language, which trumps the parent's religious convictions. So that in all cases, the best of my knowledge up to now, when a parent says, look, I'm a Jehovah's Witness or whatever it is, I don't want blood transfusion for my child, I'd rather they die, there the law overrides the parent's wishes and transfuses the child. What's not so clear is a fetus. I was in Atlanta some time ago, and I was giving a talk in the home of the person who happens to be the head of the anesthetic service in a big hospital there, and he told me that he was on duty at 3 o'clock in the morning when they got a woman like this who was pregnant, who needed a blood transfusion. The concern was the fetus's life. In other words, there was no the thought was that she would survive, but if there was, she didn't get a transfusion, the fetus would die, right? And she refused. She said, my religious beliefs preclude getting a transfusion. I refuse it. And so he told me he phoned up a judge at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he said, I want a court order now authorizing a blood. No one's dying in my operating room. The judge authorized the blood transfusion. They held the woman down against her wishes to be transfused, not to save her life, but to save the life of the fetus. That's not such a clear. And by the way, halakhically, that's also not so clear. When a woman's at risk and you could do something that would put her at risk to save the fetus, she's not really required halakhically to undergo risk to her life for the sake of the fetus. Of course, she may, but depending on the risks, but she's not obliged to. Now, halakhically, we don't take that line of thinking. We are allowed to coerce a person into treatment against their wishes under certain circumstances. There's no time now to go into the full details, but there's an excellent book on this subject. It's called Dangerous Disease and Dangerous Therapy. It's by far the best book on the subject. You need to buy at least 2 copies if you want to understand it deeply. I have a whole section there in that book on this question of coercing people into therapy and try to define the parameters. But what's unique about Israeli law, and that's the point I'd like to mention, is that in 1996, the law was passed and has been used, invoked many times in Israel today, that states that under certain circumstances, you can force a person into therapy against their wishes, right? That means we will not accept autonomy. We'll override your autonomy under certain circumstances. By the way, why does this accord with halacha? Fascinating background here. One of the themes here, halachically, that's relevant is the fact that we don't understand in halacha that you actually own your body in the first place. In other words, although you do have certain limited autonomy in many areas, but we don't consider that your life or your body, the halachic attitude is that your life and your body are a divine trusteeship that you ought to take care of, and therefore that's why you have. There's a very fascinating article, if you'd really like to enjoy something over the next few days of downtime, Rabbi Zevin, who's a very creative thinker, has an amazing halachic analysis of The Merchant of Venice. Right, Shylock's Merchant of Venice, in which I'm sure you're all black belt English literature students, and I'm sure you know that in The Merchant of Venice, the Jew Shylock makes a deal with Antonio, by which if Antonio fails to pay back his loan, Shylock will extract from him a pledge, which namely a pound of his flesh, which he'll cut out from any part of his body that he wants, and Shylock no doubt is going to cut out a pound of flesh that will cost Antonio his life. So Rabbi Zevin examines this. Others had thought about this before him, and he has a lengthy analysis on this, questioning whether this would be a valid contract in Jewish law. And the conclusion he comes to is that this wouldn't be binding in Jewish law, but the reason it wouldn't be binding is that Antonio doesn't own his body in the first place. He's not free to pledge a pound of his flesh in the first place as surety for a loan, because it's not his flesh. Right? In halacha, you don't own your body. So that's a very, very interesting and creative attack on English literature. But the point is that that's the background. Now, what Israeli law states is this. It states that under certain circumstances, you can force a patient into therapy. The conditions are that the person's got to be in danger of his life, a very, very dangerous situation, that we worry that he will die. Secondly, it must be clearly beneficial, what you're trying to do. Thirdly, there must be no alternative. If the patient says, I don't want that treatment, you've got some alternative, you have to consider that. And fourth, here's a very, very amazing condition. You have to assess that the patient will want what you did after the fact. In other words, you have to. The law states like this, that we can force this patient into treatment if we can assume that although he's refusing now, later after the fact, when he's recovered, he'll thank us and agree in retrospect. That means they basically want you to be a novi and predict what the patient's attitude is going to be in the future. Let me give you an example where this was used just to show the sense behind this. Not even an example, an extreme example. They had in Shari Tzedek Hospital a few years ago a 23-year-old girl with cancer who was unfortunately, you know, there was no real hope for her. And the thought that so she wasn't going to survive possibly more than some months or a year. But what she got was the cancer obstructed her bowel and she needed an emergency operation. The facts were that if they didn't operate, she would die in agony in the next 24 hours, 48 hours from bowel obstruction. A very simple operation could not save her life, unfortunately, but relieve the obstruction, so the next few months she could live, you know, pain-free and have whatever quality of life she could have over the next few months. And the girl refused the operation. Absolutely, flatly refused. I'm not having this operation. They said, look, if you don't have something, you're going to die in pain, and you're going to die in the next 2 days. We can relieve this obstruction very simply. Why don't you want to do it? I refuse. It's my legal right, and I'm not going to have this operation. They invoked the law, anesthetized her against her wishes, operated on her, and, of course, relieved the obstruction. When she regained consciousness, the first thing she did as soon as she could stand was she hobbled down to the hospital florist and bought a big bunch of flowers for the doctors who had saved her life and thanked them for saving her life. So they said to her, but why did you refuse in the first place? She said, I was too ashamed to tell you. I'm afraid of needles. I'm afraid of needles. She had a phobia about needles. And she was worried that, you know, they'd have to anesthetize her, she'd rather die than do that. And she didn't want to tell them that was the reason, okay? That was a very successful case of invoking the law. So if you can make a judgment that this person is making an unwise or, unbalanced decision, in that case you can actually force them to undergo therapy and save their life under those conditions. And there are various versions of this. I mean, a well-known case in Israel, in Tveria, a few years ago, was a 75-year-old lady who had gangrene of a leg or a foot or a leg, and she refused treatment. So the doctor said to her, look, if we amputate your foot, you'll be fine. You'll just have to live the next few years of your life without a foot. But if we don't, it's going to spread, and you're definitely going to die. She said, I lived with this leg, I'm dying with it. Right? And you're not removing my leg. So they questioned her, what is the anxiety? And she said this, look, how much life do I have left in this world? At best a few years. I'm going to go to another world where I'll live eternally. And there I want my leg. Right? And I'd rather die now and shorten the time I have here and live there, a whole person, right? You want to take my leg here? They said to a lady, you're making a mistake. It doesn't work that way. She said, don't tell me, What they did in this case was she was a Sephardi lady. They got the Israeli Sephardi chief rabbi to travel to Tveria. He sat at her bedside and he said, I promise you, take it from me, I promise you, if you have your leg amputated now, it will not lack it in the next world. She said, Rabbi, if that's what you say, she signed for the operation. She had her leg amputated. So, you know, you need to know what is exactly behind the thinking. So that's a unique aspect of Israeli law today that allows us, uniquely, I think, in the whole, best of my knowledge, whole Western world, to actually coerce a person under certain circumstances into treatment. By the way, in Western countries today, even if a person is morbidly depressed and they refuse treatment and they say, I want to die, and it's clear that they're terribly depressed, the law asks only one question. Not is the cause of this the depression, but are they mentally competent? That's the only question. In England today, you get a psychiatrist to testify that the person is mentally competent. That means they're competent intellectually to decide what they're doing. Even though they are clearly doing this because they're terribly depressed, their life circumstances and their depression is so bad, the law doesn't regard that. The law says that if they're intellectually competent, they're free to desist from therapy and die. Okay? Of course, the ethic here is to try to treat the depression and so on, but push comes to shove. If the person says, I don't want to be treated, of course, that is, we regard that Jewishly not only as a legal failure, but as a medical failure. Right? That's not the correct attitude from our point of view. So that's one area of law that actually in Israel uniquely accords with Jewish law. Let me mention another one which is about to come into law, probably, almost certainly, and that's probably the most recent advance in this field, and that is the question of timers on ventilators. This has been approved by the Knesset. I don't know if they've formulated a formal law yet, but the protocol has been approved by the Knesset. And Shari Tzeg and Hadassah are actually waiting to carry out a trial of this technology. Let me try to just give it a background and explain what the issue is here. You know that once a person's on a life-saving modality like a ventilator, we cannot switch that off in Jewish law. I'm not talking about intermittent-type treatment like dialysis, which gets done in cycles daily or whatever it is. I'm talking here about something that is keeping the person alive from moment to moment. So in halacha, if a person's on a ventilator, and they're dependent on the ventilator, that means if I switch it off, they will die now. That's clearly considered to be an act of murder, even though you could argue you're not doing something, you're simply removing something. But nevertheless, all the poskim agree that to switch off a ventilator, that means the immediate or very short-term death of the person, that you're not allowed to do. Now, how do we get around this problem when we need to? I'm not here going to go into the brain death question. Israeli law is unique on brain death as well. But when the person's on a ventilator and they're still alive and they're keeping their breathing, we often would like to switch off the machine for various reasons. One of them would be because, let's say, we need the machine for somebody else who could be saved in the long term, when this person is on the machine, could not be saved in the long term. A bit of a more prosaic reason might be very expensive, right, to keep this process going. There are situations where, of course, the thinking would be that if we could switch off the machine, that would be a good thing. Let me try to give you perhaps the most pressing example of this, and that is that what happens if we have a lot of people who need machines and we don't have enough machines? The thing that pushed this into the forefront of consciousness in this area was the threat some years ago of a worldwide pandemic of flu or viral infections that might leave lots of people in respiratory failure. Let's say you have a swine flu or a bird flu epidemic where lots of people are going to arrive in the hospital in respiratory failure who will need ventilation and we won't have enough machines. I was in Detroit some time ago. There's a young English rabbi who happens to be the rabbi of a big shul in Detroit. The local hospital co-opted him onto the hospital's ethics committee to make a decision. The first decision they had to make was, what will happen if there's a big epidemic of people coming in respiratory failure, we don't have enough machines, how will we triage them? How will we decide? The hospital made a decision that they will try to save all children and let all adults die. In other words, if we don't have enough machines, we'll use the machines for all children and adults will come second. These are very, very hard decisions, and they're very real decisions. And even if there's no epidemic of a disease like this, there's no question that resources are limited. Even in a country like America, there aren't always enough ICU places, ventilators for everybody who needs them. Now, what this leads to is a tragedy, and the tragedy is this. Let's say you have a hospital. This is a common scenario played out many, many times. There's a lot of awareness of this in the United States, and it's a very bitter issue. You have, let's say, an intensive care unit, and a person arrives in respiratory failure. The question is this. If we put them on a machine, can we be sure we'll ever get them off? Let's say the lungs do not recover, okay? They get lung destruction and we can't get them off the machine. We're now going to have a hopeless person on a machine that we could be using to save somebody else who could be saved. This person's going to die anyway, and at the moment they're tying up the machine. The modern approach to this is tragic. The modern approach is this. In order not to get that into that situation, let's try to select patients that we think are more likely to recover. In other words, we want to be very selective in our criteria. Let's be very, very narrow. Let's choose patients that look to us like they'll probably recover so that they'll get off the machine successfully with other people, which means lots of people get left to die. That means if we don't think you look as likely to recover as somebody else, we don't put you on a machine because somebody else is going to get it before you. Undoubtedly, this means that lots of people are being sent out to die, so to speak, who could have recovered. No doubt many wouldn't have, but no doubt some would have, and this is a bitter triage issue. The suggestion has been made to solve the problem in the following way. This suggestion was made, I remember, at least 20 years ago, 15, 20, by Rav Zilberstein. I don't know if it was taken seriously then, but right now it's being taken very seriously. Let's not be so selective in our criteria for triage. Let's put everybody onto ventilators, but put the ventilators onto pre-timed cutoffs. That means this person will be on a machine for 3 days or a week, whatever time window you feel you need to come to clarity about their possible recovery. The machine will then switch off automatically. We won't switch off the machine. We'll let it switch off automatically. Where if you look like you're recovering, we'll keep the machine going. When it switches off, we'll switch it on again. But if you look like you're not recovering, and you look hopeless, we gave you a trial of therapy, and now it looks hopeless, we will have society will have agreed this is how we'll handle it. And what will happen is, when that ventilator gets to its timed endpoint, whether it's a day later or a week later, we'll simply stand back when it switches off and not switch it on again. Okay? Of course, the ideal situation will be we will switch it on again on somebody else, but not on this person who will be left to die. The meaning of this will be that we won't be switching off machines actively and killing people, and we will be saving many lives because we'll be putting many people onto a trial of therapy who wouldn't have got tried in the first place. That's the thinking, okay? So what's happened now is that Hadassah has developed a ventilator like this that has a timed cutoff. They took a long time to develop the technology, actually. Let's explain that also briefly. And they now have a machine that works very well on models, in other words, on inanimate model situations. It's never been tried on a human. They are now waiting to run a trial. Hadassah and Shaarei Tzedek have agreed on a protocol for a clinical trial. They're waiting for Helsinki Committee approval. There's a Helsinki Committee is an international committee of medical ethics. and various other ethical type situations. They want Helsinki Committee approval because they want it to have international recognition, and therefore the bureaucracy is taking time, but when they get approval, they'll run the trial. The technology is very interesting. It took a long time to actually build the machine. You may ask, what's the problem of putting, come to my house, I'll give you a Shabbos clock. You put the Shabbos clock on the ventilator. You set the Shabbos clock the way you want it. What's the problem, right? You might think it's a trivial engineering problem, but it's a very complex engineering problem. The reason is, can you think, why am I doing all the thinking? Why is it problematic to get a ventilator to cut off at a pre-timed interval? The reason is this, that ICU ventilators are built in such a way that they refuse to switch off. They've got such alarms and such backups. The last thing you want is a machine switching off and just passively not telling you. So when you trip the current, the power, to an ICU ventilator, it goes crazy. It starts beeping alarms and it starts triggering backups. And So you have to develop, you have to override, but you don't want to override the emergency that you need. So you have to have a sophisticated way of getting your machine to switch you off reliably without complaining when you wanted to, and yet not trip or result in respond to a power failure by letting the person die, right? This takes creative thinking. So it took time to get the technology to the point where you can actually set the thing to switch off and yet not defeat the alarms and backups that the ventilators have. The trial they're thinking of running is actually a very interesting trial. In order to get approval for this trial and to have the high ground, let's say the moral and ethical high ground in this trial, they've decided to run the first clinical trial on people who were going to die sooner anyway. In other words, the way they run the trial is like this. They selected a group of patients who have degenerative disease, right? Like, let's say, ALS, a neurodegenerative disease, which will eventually leave the people with inability to breathe. When the respiratory nerves and muscles are affected, the people will not be able to breathe, and no one will put people on ventilators because they will never recover. And therefore, what they've done is they've selected a group of patients like that. The logic being that they've said to people like this, you have this disease, which means that in a certain amount of time, there's nothing we'll be able to do for you, you're going to die. At that point, and these are people who've said at that point they don't want further therapy. The suffering, the pain is too great. These are people who've said, when I get to that point, just take care of my pain and don't prolong my agony in that situation. So they said to people like this, we know those are your wishes and we respect them. We would like you to help us in a trial that may save lives in the future. What we're asking you to do is agree to be part of our trial, which means that when you get to that endpoint where you said you want to die, and you would be dying within hours after that, let us put you on one of our machines and keep you going for another week. Okay? A week later, the machine will switch off, and then you will die, because by then you will not be able to recover. But you said you want to die anyway. We'll be giving you extra time. We're not going to be depriving you of time. Because of our trial that you'll participate in, you'll live an extra week or month or whatever time we agree. And then, unfortunately, nothing we'll be able to do for you. And when the machine switches off, we'll allow you to die. But the argument is that at least in the experimental phase of this thing, that no one will say you're killing people or making people die sooner than they would have. The argument will be every single one on this trial is living longer than he would have lived had we not put him on this trial. That's the thinking, and that's why they've targeted that particular type of disease so that they can run this clinical trial. If it works and everyone's happy with the results, then the thought is that it will actually be formalized as a part of the so-called Dying Patient Act, which is Knesset has already approved in principle, and then this technology will be rolled out. I personally have very little doubt that we'll soon see it coming to a hospital near you. I think that it's almost inevitable once the technology, society will simply agree on the protocols, what sort of time intervals will be used for what sort of situations, and that will seriously relieve the pressure on selection of people for ventilation, and solve the problem of having to switch people off. Zilberstein originally suggested this in a triage situation where you're dealing with a Chaye Shah against a Chaye Olam. So in a situation where the Chaye Shah comes in first, Zilberstein said, why not just put them on this machine and keep them going indefinitely? But if you get a Chaye Olam who comes in, and they clearly can be saved, and there's only one machine, then since you can't switch it off on the first person, wait until it switches off by itself. And of course, now you loy samad al dam reacha means you have to switch it on again. But in this case, you can switch it on to somebody else who's now here, and this person could be saved in the long term. Now, that was a suggestion that he made years ago, and I think that'll be one of the applications of this situation. So those are two areas of law in Israel that do accord with, or at least there's been rabbinic approval of this ventilator situation. And I think Professor Steinberg told us that they actually asked Rav Eliashiv about this, and therefore the protocols went ahead on the basis of that heter. So that's a thing I think that we'll see soon. Do I have time for one more? Thanks. There's another area of law in Israel, which is part of the dying patient situation. I think this law was this aspect of the law came into force in 2005, 2006 or 7 or 8, somewhere around there, and that is that they allow protocols for DNRs, in other words, for living wills. You can state what you want to be done to you in certain situations of serious illness. In other countries, of course, very simple procedure. You simply have a so-called living will. You say what you want to be, have your life prolonged under certain circumstances. What's done in Israel is that they have a registry. What they do is this: they try to get as many people in the population to fill in these forms as possible. You can put all sorts of halachic criteria that you under competent halachic guidance. Shaaretz Tzedek Hospital, for example, has a card you can carry, which says, I give permission for my organs to be used for transplantation after my death. You then check off which organ you mean, organs, and there's a final checkbox which says, if you wish, you can check it. It says, under competent halachic guidance. So that you can, and you can stipulate, of course, all the criteria and details you want. Now, what this registry, what this thing does is, it's a law that, first of all, mandates palliative care. That means that, unlike in other countries where palliative care, that means relieving pain and being as humane as possible to people who are dying, is an ethic, in Israel it's actually a law. So that they mandate care for people who are dying pain relief, and the law specifically states that you're obliged to treat the patient even when there may be risk in the treatment. Right? At this time, I'll try to explain that in a bit more detail, but in other words, the law accepts that if you do something to relieve pain, like give drugs that will relieve pain, and these drugs may shorten life or be risky, you're protected by law, because the law considers that it's worth taking a certain amount of risk to relieve severe pain. And of course, given the correct limitations and halachic boundaries, that does accord with halacha. At the time, I'll try to speak about that a bit more. The law also says that that in cases of dispute, let's say there are ethical issues to be decided, where the patient, it's not clear how long the patient, what the patient's wishes were. So that is solved by, not by a court of law in Israel, but the law requires that it's solved by an ethics committee. In other words, in other countries, sometimes you get very bitter arguments in court when families start arguing about what should be done for an unconscious or dying patient. In Israel, those sorts of things are not deemed to be legal. They're deemed to be, let's call them, they're ethical, but let's call halachic areas, and an ethics committee is required to make those decisions. If you're not happy with the decision, you can appeal it to a national ethics committee, but not to a court of law. In other words, again, Israeli law defines these types of questions as questions that, rather than clog up the courts, are decided by ethics committees, which are made up of various ways around Israel. If there's a challenge, what you call an appeal, it goes to a national ethics committee to decide. The only way you can take a case like this to court is if you claim incompetence or legal impropriety or something going wrong. If you accuse that process of being invalid, you can take it to court. But if it's only the weighing up of a family's feelings, whether then that is a thing. And one of the things this law does is it has set up a registry of people's wishes. In other words, you fill in forms, you say what you want to be done under terminal and desperate circumstances. And then they are obliged to follow the patient's wishes, which again, in many cases, does accord with halacha, provided, of course, what the patient said accords with halachic norms. What's unique about this law is, first of all, it's kept on a national computerized database, which means any hospital or doctor anywhere in Israel at any time of the day or night can access that registry and look up, if this patient's unconscious and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, we can access what they have written is what they would have wanted done to them. Secondly, it needs to be renewed every 5 years. It's not valid unless you have renewed it every 5 years. The reason for this is much research has shown that what people write about what they would like to be done to them when they're desperately ill or very old and very sick, their attitudes change through life as they get older. So to try to preclude that a person wrote 30 years ago what they would want done when they're 85, so this has to be updated every 5 years. Thirdly, it has to be updated in a case of desperate illness. In other words, if the person gets very seriously ill and they're competent, they are conscious and competent, the registry is visited, and they have to update and ratify or change what it is. And the reason for this is because a lot of research around the world has shown that what people say when they're not sick does not always accord. There's a very high incidence of that not according with what they say when they are sick. Many people have said, well, if I'm desperately ill and in pain and so forth, don't save me. And yet when they get into that situation, doctor, do anything to get me to that bar mitzvah of a grandchild or whatever it is, and therefore to make sure that the patient's wishes are still valid, that has to be updated when they get into a situation of dangerous illness. And that registry is maintained, and those are the conditions under which it's been maintained. So that's another area of law in Israel that accords with, let's say, at least to some extent, accords with halacha. And finally, maybe just to mention, there is the Brain Death Act in Israel. That's, again, mid-2008, somewhere like that. The Brain Death Act, which the law in Israel does accord here with secular norms, with Western norms, regarding brain death as a valid criteria. I'm sure you know, and I'm sure that a lot of people here know, that there's a big debate and a long-standing, vexed, inflamed issue about whether brainstem death, is a valid halachic criterion for death. Okay, the traditional halachic criteria is certainly not based on brainstem function, and although there are rabbis and poskim who do agree that brainstem death should be approved, and the Israeli chief rabbinate has taken that line, but major poskim in the last generation and this have not really gone with the brain death standard. Now, Israeli law actually does approve brain stem death as a valid criterion, but it has some interesting conditions that other countries don't have. One of the things it says is that although we regard brain stem death as valid, but they require much more stringent criteria for diagnosing it than other countries. In most countries today, all countries, to the best of my knowledge, all you need to diagnose brainstem death is clinical criteria. In other words, examine the patient, check the reflexes, and in some countries you need two doctors. In some countries you need a doctor who is independent of the case and certainly independent of any transplants that might be considered. In many countries where transplants are going to be done, there's a fear that we may diagnose brain death a little too soon, hastily, because we want to use their organs. So some countries require a neurologist who's not part of the transplant team to approve the brain, and some countries require revisiting the decision in 24 hours to see if anything's changed before you switch off the machines and so forth and so on. In Israel today, they require also testing of brainstem blood flow, whether it's Doppler testing or radioactive dyes that are checked on X-ray. They want to be sure that not only the patient meets clinical criteria, but actually there are investigations can be done to show that there's no brainstem function or brain flow. That's one particular criterion. I think they also need the chief rabbi's signature. They have other checks and balances. And also, uniquely, you can disagree with it if you have religious objections. I don't know. In other words, if you say that although the law of the land defines this as brain death, and the law allows us now to switch off the machine, I am an Orthodox Jew, I don't accept that, my rabbi, my whatever it is, my poisek, I do not accept brainstem death. The law actually allows, although the law comes down on the side of accepting brainstem death and allows it to be used as a definition, you are free to say, I don't want to accept that criteria, and the law then is required to follow your opinion so that they will then continue therapy and not switch off the machine.
Except the machine will turn itself off.
Except if the machine, of course, will have a timer that will...
Thank you.